Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
No, but I've got.
It's a fucking nightmare.
Just hit record.
Can you hear yourself?
The voice you're hearing right now, ladies and gentlemen, is the pit bull of comedy himself, Bobby Slayton.
Are we on?
Oh yeah, we're on.
Okay, Robbie, can you hear yourself well? Are you good? Do you want more than headphones?
I can't hear me, but as long as you can hear me.
No, which you're.
I can hear.
You got to turn the headphones on.
What's that?
You got to turn the.
I got to turn the headphones on. Well, it shows you what.
Other side.
Such a retard. Now I sound great.
Yeah,
now,
okay, now that.
The sound of Adam Ray's and my voice is that's. This is about to be the last time you hear it because we're just going to say hi to Bobby.
Yeah.
Bobby's going to go.
You know what? First of all, I want to say, you know, when somebody told me the other day, you know what it was? I was on Kevin and Bean on K-Rock.
So you can hug that mic a little bit more.
You were calling in, right?
Yeah.
Weren't you calling in?
Oh, yeah. You were in the studio before.
Yeah. And
I came in right behind you, I think.
Right. And they said, have you ever done Adam and Brad's radio show, podcast? And I said, no. They all. It's really great. And then I called you up, Brad, and I said, God, I can't believe he's never asked me to do the podcast. But you want to know something? There are so many comics now. You know, I did the same thing with Mark Maron. I did the same thing with Doug Benson. I did the same thing with all these guys. Oh, yeah, you could come do my podcast anytime. Right. I don't think you guys need to call anybody. I shouldn't take it so personally because you must have, like, there's like a million comics. There's a million podcasts.
Yeah.
And so there's no reason to. I thought, they were calling me. Nobody ever calls me about it. We didn't know you wanted to do it. Yeah.
Well, to be honest, Bobby, we think you're too big for us.
No, I'm not too big for anybody. Maybe a year ago. I'm too big for you. That was only a short joke.
Well, a dog is too big for Brad. But
meanwhile, I was making fun of his car. He's got that Mini Cooper on front. But I'm in no position to make fun of that car because that car is. I'm parked right behind it. My car is a Cube, a Nissan Cube. Now, if you don't know what a Cube is, and my wife and I, things are going so bad for me. I'll tell you about the go. My wife and I are not only sharing a car, we're sharing a Nissan Cube. And this is the kind of, I'm not a macho guy. If I had all the money in the world, if I had Seinfeld money, I still wouldn't be driving a $100,000 Vette or a Jag. I don't need that shit, but I don't know if I'd have a Cube. Matter of fact, yesterday I went to Home Depot and the Mexicans in the parking lot were asking me if I needed work. That's good night, ladies and gentlemen. And it's always kind of jokes that got me to Las Vegas.
What kind of a car is a Cube?
It's exactly what the name is. It's a Cube. It's like a Chevy Astro van that got hit with the Rick Moranis "Honey, I Shrunk the Kids" ray.
Yeah,
wow.
It's down.
So
there.
it's like two fat kids sharing a snow cone. It's just not going to work
think
for anybody.
Two fat kids would fit in it if they they call it a cube because they called it a refrigerator or a mini stove. Nobody would really. It has to have some kind of name that sounds like it might actually do something. But if you ever in a hotel room and you need a fridge for the room and you order a fridge, it's that with wheels and half a horsepower. But his car's parked right in front. I said, "Brad, is that your car, the Mini Cooper?" He goes, "Yeah." And that car you think is really small.
Oh yeah,
but it's not. I mean, no. Penn Jillette, who's like 9 feet tall,
right. Drives one too.
I was over at his house. I go, "How do you fit in that?" And it's really deceptive because when you get in that car, it really has.
Yeah, I know Penn Jillette drives one. Alonzo Bowden drives one.
Does he really?
Yeah, and then me. So you have these two giants and then like the guy who actually looks like he should be driving a Mini Cooper. Yeah.
The guy who's going to fight the giant.
Pretty much.
For the village to bring peace to the... Now, how long have you been married?
Oh, man. We talked about that before I went on the air. I was going to tell you, I've been married for 25 years. And, you know, for a comic to be married that long is pretty...
Oh, it's bananas. Yeah,
that's pretty impressive. Amazing.
Well, you know what it is, too? It's also because once you have a kid, it's like having a dog. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to see the kid and raise the kid. You don't want visitation, right? So it makes you stick up. You stick around with the wife a little bit more. And then when you buy a house and you don't want to give this fucking bitch anything, so you kind of hold on to the house. And so you kind of make things work. It's sort of like being on Gilligan's Island and building shit out of coconut shells. You just make it work. Tom Hanks.
Marriage is like Gilligan's Island.
Marriage is just like Gilligan's Island. Yeah. Only you don't get to fuck Barry Ann.
You make do. Tom Hanks, his best friend, becomes a soccer ball. You know, when you're stuck in a situation,
Marriage is the deserted island.
Now, how much of your act became about your marriage once you Was it like right now? Because I have, I'm, you know, I'm 31. Yeah. I have a ton of friends getting married. Right. I feel like unless my friends, all my friends that aren't comics are married or right. are about to be.
Right.
And so I'm starting to, you know, and having kids. And so I have a lot of material now about just that happening and being the friend of them who's not married with kids. Right. So how much of that did you also have? And then when you got married, did you just have a whole act about?
Well, it's interesting. I got married at your age. I got married, I think I was, I was 31. My wife was 32. Mm-hmm. So we weren't these assholes that got married. Like our parents and grandparents, a lot of them got out of high school, went into the army, or got out of college and, you know, went to medical school or got out of high school, and got, you know, whatever it was, a lot of these people got married at 18 to 22. So, which is mind-boggling to me because you don't have a life. It could be the first person you've had sex with, or even if it's a second or third or whatever, the fact that you just got out of high school, just got out of the military, just got out of a job, just got out of college, and now you got a wife, you don't have 1 minute your pathetic macho male life where you could just pee on the toilet seat or in the bathtub if you're drunk or spoil your appetite or you know, or play a video game or do whatever the hell you want when you want to do it and sneak snacks into a movie theater. Just live on the edge and go crazy because you got a fucking broad you got to talk to. First it's your parents, then it's your gym coach, then it's your guidance counselor, then it's your math teacher, now it's a goddamn wife, then you have a kid, and then you got to go to Disneyland, and your whole life's fucked. I mean,
you got to go to Disneyland. You get to go to Disneyland.
Well, I wonder.
Or I guess when you have a wife and a kid, it's you have to go, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. Disneyland to me, when I was a kid, you know, growing up in New York, you know, Disneyland was, wow, you know, very few friends of mine.
You made it if you got to go there?
No, I mean, there's a couple of friends of mine that, wow, you went to Disneyland. Yeah. But, see, I remember when Disney was for people first getting color televisions and Disney was in color. And there was a whole mystique about Disney, you know? And it was great.
There was this whole anti-Semitic mystique to
it. That was great. The fact that he hated Jews, too. I went to Hebrew school. I liked him more for that. and I'm Jew.
Wait, because
he hates Jews.
Wait, why'd you like him more?
Just I hate these people, too. This is great.
I'm a Jew. I don't like to admit because I went to Hebrew school. It made me hate Jews.
Yeah, me too.
And people go, I can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery because all my ink, and fine. We need to be right next to Juice. What do I do? Give a rat's ass.
You sit next to him in a deli for 30 years. That's enough.
Give a rat's ass where I'm buried. In fact, my wife talked to me about that last week. Out of the blue. No, I mean, I'm having
Where do you want to be buried?
No, I'm having one of my rare decent days at home where the creditors aren't calling. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go to some shithole funny bone in Boise, Idaho or something. And everything's fine for the week. And my wife goes, you know, we should talk about getting cremated. And I said, we're like not even, we're on our 50s. And I'm thinking, if you're thinking about doing it now, I'll be more than happy to help you. I'd be more than happy to throw some kerosene on you like a Buddhist monk. You want to die now for some war in some foreign third world country? Kill yourself. I'd be happy to.
What preceded that? Was it like, what do you want for dinner tonight? Oh, by the way, how do you want to die?
I don't know why she said it.
And is she Jewish too? Or
no, she's just a cunt. Am I the first one to say that on this show?
But that might be the greatest line.
That's one word.
Your delivery is unreal.
But you want to know something, though.
What's that?
I called her that the other night. But here's what's really interesting.
You called her that and you're still married?
No, but that's the thing. Listen, you guys will appreciate this. Yeah. You'll appreciate this. She was acting like a cunt, and I told her that, and she got really mad.
Yeah.
But she missed the point because she thought I called her a cunt, and I said, you're acting. I said, I was trying to compliment her on her acting abilities. I said to her, I said, look, I've been in a lot of movies and TV shows, but I suck. I play this fast-talking Jew. I do the same character. But the way you act, I thought you were really being a cunt. And I said, you know, I've worked with some. I work with Cate Blanchett. If you watch Al Pacino in Scarface and you really study it, nitpick, you can see him once in a while going out of character. And I said to my wife, last night when you acted like a cunt, I mean, it was seamless. It was flawless. Meryl Streep has nothing on you. And she was getting more angry. And I just kept trying to tell her, I'm trying to compliment her what a good actress she was. And I said, and the only reason I want you to stop acting like that is because I'm afraid you're going to get typecast, getting back to Gilligan. Gilligan, this happened. We don't need you two guys. I can handle the show.
I'm just going to sit back,
set you
take
up,
the headphones off.
But Gilligan, I was talking about, I met Bob Denver. You know, he died, I think, six, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
But I was going to do a voiceover audition. They don't call me anymore either.
We do a lot of Family Guy.
I did a lot of voices, but I don't.
Which one of the, you did one of the
I only played
the Mafia, right?
I was on it once. No, I played, actually, you would think a Mafia guy would be perfect.
Sure.
I played an Indian chief.
That's what it was. When Peter has to go on the spiritual retreat.
The Vision Quest.
The Vision Quest. Because when I saw Family Guy, I was like, I know the episode, but that's right.
You know, it's funny because
That's awesome, right?
Yeah, it was. Not only was it awesome, but it was the first season of the show. And I've been doing a lot of voice work at the time. Now nobody calls anymore. As a matter of fact, some comedian, get a load of this. And I'll get back to Gilligan and get back to Family Guy.
Totally. I know where we're going.
As long as you guys don't talk, I'll remember everything.
we got the map. You're driving.
Perfect.
Okay. All right. So I used to do a lot of voiceovers, and about 6 months ago, I went into my agent. I never get calls anymore. They always think I'm on the road. I'm not on the road. I could do podcasts. I could do anything. I'll help you wash your car. I need to make some money. So I
almost took a gig playing Superman at a kid's birthday party when I was so low on money. So,
really?
Yeah.
Holy
yeah.
shit.
If I was in better shape, I should play Lois Lane.
He's got better tits.
He's better tits. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm with this comic. He goes, hey, how come you didn't come in to read for that thing last week? And I go, what thing? It said, looking for a Bobby Slayton type.
What?
And I said, yeah. I said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? A Bobby Slayton. I'm still alive. I could still be me if I have to. They were looking for a Bobby Slayton type like I'm dead. I mean, that was a kick in the butt.
But, Jesus.
What I was going to say was, so about Family Guy. So I was doing this whenever it came on the air. It must have been always, God, it must be 10 years because I was in my old house, 10, 12 years ago. And I got this call. We want you to come in to do this audition for a new animated show. And I was really feeling under the weather. And I was leaving the next day for some shitty comedy club.
Sure.
And like there's any other kind.
What does your voice sound like when it's under the weather, by the way?
It sounds like this.
It's like you said.
It's me on a good day, it's me on a bad day. It never used to be this deep. It's just yelling and the fact that I think Satan's living inside my body.
You have an incredible voice, though.
Yeah, but it's just one of my many personalities. Yeah. This is my podcast
For
voice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Perfect.
My podcast voice. I have my own.
You have a Trader Joe's voice.
I have a gay marriage voice. I have it. Just I blend in with anybody. I'm like Zelling. So anyway, they called me up, and I wasn't feeling well. I was leaving the next day, and they said, yes, this new animated show, Seth MacFarlane. Nobody knew who he was. And they said, well, he really wants to use you in one of the episodes. I said, fine, but I'm not coming. I forget it, because I never get these things anyway.
Sure.
And they called back, and they said, will you do it over the phone? I never did a voiceover audition over the phone. And, yeah. I was coughing. I had Robitussin, and I was all fucked up. And I did the voice. They go, great, you got it. I said, fine. Anyway, I went in to do the part, and the show hadn't been on TV yet. I go, this is the dumbest show. This show's never going to go anywhere. It's like McFarlane's doing all those goofy voices, and I'm doing the Indian Chief. I don't know what the fuck.
British baby and stuff like that. You're like, this will never work.
Right. So over the next few months, people started saying, have you seen Family Guy? I saw you on Family Guy. It was great. And I finally watched my episode, and I go, okay, this show's okay. And then I'm sitting in a hotel room. I watch another episode. This show's not bad. And then after three or four episodes, I go, this is one of the funniest, greatest animated just shows.
Yep.
It's up there with The Simpsons. It's great. Mm-hmm. And that's why Seth MacFarlane's a billionaire, and I'm still playing this shit all funny. What do I know about anything?
Well, yeah, but you went with your instincts, you know, and like.
So Gilligan, can I finish that story?
Yeah, exactly.
You keep Gilligan. Interrupting me. You ruined the whole show. So about 6-7 years ago, right before he died, I see Bob Denver at an audition. And like the idiot I am, you guys would probably do the same thing. Hey, Gilligan.
Right.
And he goes ballistic on me.
He's one of those guys that doesn't want to be referred to.
Well, I think what happened to him is there was a whole generation of kids, including me, who grew up in the 60s. That's all I knew him from. I mean, in the 50s, during the golden age of television, he was on Dobie Gillis. And according to him, he did Shakespeare in the Park. And he did the London stage. And he did Broadway. And he says to me, that's all anybody remembers me is Gilligan. Anyway, I try to explain that to my wife, that if she keeps acting like a cunt, it's going to happen to her. I think she's going to walk down the street and go, well, there's that fucking cunt. I'm going to go, no, she just plays one on TV. And I said, you're going to get typecast if you keep playing the same role like Gilligan. You're going to wind up like Gilligan with a vagina, honey, and I don't want to see that happen to you.
Gilligan with a vagina.
That could be a great show.
That was the spinoff, yes. It didn't, yeah.
Yes.
Now, how long have you been doing comedy for?
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Well,
when did you consider yourself to be funny and you're like, all right, I'm going to try to make a career out of this? Was there a moment? A couple weeks ago?
No, when I first did stand-up, I was 21, but, you know, I think Jerry Seinfeld once said the same thing. He goes, I didn't count the first year, but I didn't count it because I only did it once. So
right. Okay.
I really started when I was 22, and now I'm 58, so a little bit over 25 years. 35 years, oh, my God. But, you know, when I started, that's why my book's called If You Can't Laugh at Yourself, Make Fun of Other People, My 35 Years in Showbiz Hell, and it's been nothing but. It's been hell. My life's not hell. I mean, it's not like I'm going for a liver transplant or kidney dialysis, but as far as showbiz goes, I'm doing worse than you two. I'm driving a fucking cube.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but then, so, you, I mean, because you've been in the business 35 years, and I was on your website. You got pictures with Rickles. You got pictures with, like, just, like, you've met everyone in this business. You had pictures hanging out with Robin Williams, and you guys were like in your 30s and stuff.
Yeah, but remember, if you go to any dry cleaner, he has the same pictures because they also go to the car wash and the dry cleaner. So every guy with a tattoo parlor has a picture with Motley Crue and Motorhead. Yeah, everybody's got pictures.
Hot dogs.
Yeah, but I worked with a lot of these guys. And a matter of fact, one of the chapters of my book is called Typhoid Bobby after Typhoid Mary, who never had typhoid, but she gave it to dozens and dozens of people. She was a carrier. So like me, I'm a carrier of the fame gene, even though I haven't become a big star. But Ray Romano, Judd Apatow, Roseanne Barr, my God, David Spade, Bill Hicks. I mean, there's 100 guys that have opened. Chelsea Handler. Oh, mm-hmm. She... Oh, a horrible woman. The story of my book about her. Except I got to watch what I say about her, because I heard I could get sued, because she likes to sue if you say things, even though they're true.
No kidding.
But anyway, so there's a lot of...
And you wonder why you haven't been asked on the show.
Well, you know what? I was... No, but she opened up for me. And, mm-hmm. and then I heard when I tried to get on the show that the producer said, Bobby, you're just trying to take over the show. I'm not like that, am I, fellas?
Not at all. I keep looking at you like, when is Bobby going to show up?
Oh, Brad, I forgot what your voice sounded like there for a minute.
Well, you know, I just don't like that show and everything she does to the comics on the show. You know, if you're, okay, let the queen talk. Let the queen bitch talk. You've had enough. You know, stop being so funny. Sit down. You know, you know.
Yeah, I understand. Adam was just on that show, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, first time.
There's nothing wrong with doing the show.
Yeah, you know, sure.
The thing with that show is it's catapulted a lot of comics, good ones and horrible ones.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Into, you know, the spotlight, because people that are going to comedy clubs now are not people my age. They're not people in their 50s. It's kids in their 20s and 30s and right. 40s who watch Comedy Central, who basically, you know, buys comics for $1,500 and then gives out specials like Halloween candy to anybody that, you know, they can own. But that's what's putting asses in the seats now.
Yeah. Not you would crush on that show, by the way. You're so quick. And I mean, also, it would be amazing to see, at the rate that you speak, like battling with Chelsea and the
people.
That's
why she wanted me on the show, because exactly. She knows that I will do that. Yeah. And not on purpose, but, I think.
And you would think, though, you would want to be like, well, okay, this would be you would help the show by having you on. So it's like.
You know, you think that. That's why a guy like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, you look at a guy like him. When that show first came on, Jerry knew he wasn't a great actor. And mm-hmm. what did he do? He surrounded himself with great, funny people.
Yeah, sure.
He's making the money. The show's called Seinfeld. And he's more than happy to let everybody else do the work and
make, star and,
make him yeah. rise. And it went beautifully. But there are some, you know, Ray Romano did the same thing. He put his mm-hmm. friends on. And a lot of guys did it. But there are some people that just want the whole spotlight and don't want to, you know.
Yeah.
I find that to be hard to believe. Like Jay Leno put some comics on. But somebody said, well, Leno doesn't want comics being on who are funny than them. I don't think that's true. I think
no, he put plenty of comics
on. He put plenty of comics on. He might not put as many as Letterman because the ratings aren't as high. That's a whole different thing. But I think that anybody involved in this business who wants the show to be better would surround themselves with friends and funny people.
Right.
Now, you had a gig going on at, what was it, the Hooters Casino?
That was a great gig. I didn't realize how great it was.
I guess, okay, because that's what I was going to ask you, because I ran into Frank Caliendo one time, and he had his gig going on at the
Monte Carlo, yeah. Red Cross Street.
And I asked him, like, dude, so you're doing Vegas now. Like, you don't have to travel a lot. You don't got to do anything. And, like, how is it? And Frank looks at me and goes, I've never been more miserable in my entire life. And I'm like, what the fuck? Because that sounds like a dream gig to me.
Well, you know, with Frank, what happened was, and I don't know if this to be true, I mean, I don't know how packed the show was, but then again, he had a giant theater. And
right.
by the time Frank got there, the recession mm-hmm. was starting to hit. Vegas was starting to hurt.
Yeah,
that had
true.
Nothing to do with Frank's talent, because he's great.
Yeah.
I only had a 200-seat showroom to fill. I loved playing Vegas, but I was also at a place... I was at Hooters. And if you've ever been to a Hooters, mm-hmm. all this is the same shithole except for a couple of tables and a couple of more fat people and, you know, and a few slot machines. But they built a beautiful showroom for me, and they paid mm-hmm. me a salary. And I was the only guy on the strip, out of the guys of my generation, you know, Penatella, Carrot Top, George Wallace, Rita Rudner, everybody was working. I was getting a paycheck. You know, I was mm-hmm. getting a really nice pay. A lot of those guys were working for two-wall and four-wall deals and percentage of the door. But I was getting paid. And they put me up in a beautiful apartment next door.
Whoa.
So I was right there. But Hooters was, I've never seen an operation like this. It was like the mental patients. It was like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was like the patients running the institution. They didn't know what they were doing. I mean, they closed a sushi bar right before I got there. The sushi bar was called the Bait Shop. Mm-hmm. That's not what you should call it.
No, no.
You know, yeah. I mean, there's a bakery in New York called Hot and Crusty. That's not what they call a doctor, a gynecologist's office. You know, Hot and Crusty is not good for a brothel. It's good for a bakery. You know, there's certain names. The Bake Shop's great.
Yeah. Right.
A bake shop.
Sure.
But sushi is a hard enough sell in a place like Hooters. But that's the kind of way, that's the way they were thinking. They had a martini bar that they turned into a showroom for me. Mm-hmm. The martini bar didn't work because nobody goes to Hooters for a martini.
You don't right. say.
Those people, well, yeah. I, and I I knew that. They go, you know, if they get a Coors, you know, it's Coors Light, Miller Light, and
Coors Law and titties, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
How was the shows though? I mean, the clientele that came in there.
For the most part, it was good, but it was a tough sell anywhere. Vegas, you know, Vegas is not like the old days. First of all, when you're playing Hooters, you're off the strip, and right in front of you is the Tropicana, mm-hmm. who's offering, I think, three comics for $15, and you get a free drink. And my tickets are three times.
I did
much.
That gig, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Comedy Stop at the Trop,
right?
Bob Gephardt's gig,
right? And that was a horrible enough gig the way it was, but
yeah,
that
two
was
shows a night for yeah. a week,
right? And so you have to even go further off this trip to get to Hooters. And then across the street, you got Carrot Top. You have Frank Caliendo. At the time, I think Rita Rudner or Roseanne or Louis was across the street in New York, New York. And every week at the MGM was either a fight, Louis Black, Robin Williams, or David Copperfield. So the people go to Vegas. They only go to see one show. And they're not mm-hmm. going to see Bobby Slayton. And they're not going to Hooters. So the combination was not a good 1-2 punch at all. But I was there for 2 years. I had a contract.
There you go.
And you know what I did that the other comedy clubs got pissed at me?
What's
is
up?
That I overpaid. Overpay is not the right word because I don't think I overpaid him, but I was paying all my openers $1,500 a week for Wednesday through Sunday.
Wow.
And as you know, that if you were a headliner, you would probably get that at the most.
Yeah.
At any one of those comedy clubs and the Improv and the Comedy Stop and all of them. I can't believe you're paying your openers $1,500. And I go, well, you know what? I'm making pretty good coin, mm-hmm. and nobody ever took care of the comics, and so I paid them $1,500. And you know,
that's
I didn't
super
have to.
Generous. Yeah, of course.
I mean, I took them all out to dinner. I mean, I did what I had to do because I don't want to be treated like shit by all these other clubs.
Well, because you know, I mean, I feel like you came up through the ranks, and you probably had some guys at the top treat you like shit when you were coming up.
Yeah, well, not treat me like shit so much as didn't really give me the time of day. I mean. Mm-hmm. But you know what? When I was an opening act, yeah, I was a house comic at the. I got a lot of time. People ask me all the time, "Hey, get good at stand up." And I don't know how you guys got good. I don't know how you guys, when you start out, where you got a lot of time to do it. But I was the house MC at the Punchline in San Francisco, one of the first comedy clubs.
Nice. I'm going there at the end of July.
What's that?
I'm going there at the end of July.
It's still a great club. And about 25, 30 years ago, so I opened up for Jerry Seinfeld,
wow.
and George Wallace, and Michael Batman Keaton,
Jesus.
You know, Bruce Baum, Denny Johnston, Elaine Boozler, you know, Leno.
They all came through there.
Yeah, so I got to watch them all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back then.
You feel like that helps you get better when you're starting out to watch?
I think it helps. I don't think it helps so much if you watch on TV now. I think now, I don't know if it's easier for a comic or tougher for a comic because there's so many guys doing it. Mm-hmm. And everything's almost been done,
you know? Yeah, I mean, yeah, because people are sitting there going like, okay, well, I got stuff going on with my girlfriend. Yeah, stuff has been going on with comics girlfriends for 40 years.
I mean,
it's tough.
Like four dwarves doing stand-up. And after the first 10 minutes of short jokes, you better be a good comic.
Yeah. Sure.
It's like blind comics. There's a dozen of those guys. And that's fine being blind and fat and handicapped. But after that, you just better be funny.
Yeah.
You know, your disease or your problem or your handicap can work for you, as you know.
As I know.
Yeah, as you know. But then you got to be a funny guy.
Sure.
You know? And I think when I started out, there weren't that many people. Well, there were a lot of people doing it, but not as many.
Mm-hmm.
So there was more places you could go. San Francisco alone, the whole Bay Area, that whole comedy boom in the early 80s,
yeah,
there were about four or five full-time comedy clubs and four or five clubs that had one-night gigs. So between San Jose and San Francisco and Marin County, you could work every night.
Wow.
You know? And then there's a lot of guys like Robin Williams. And Robin had just – I remember when he first got Mork and Mindy. And that was – we were all in the early 20s, I guess. And
that was a big deal, yeah? I mean, it was
– it was a really big deal. But Robin, you knew right away. Was going to be a giant star. I was a
doormat. How so?
Because just watching him, he was a force of nature. I mean, now you watch him, big deal, because there's so many guys you might think.
Sure.
But Robin was, with his voices and his characters, before Mork and Mindy, there was nobody really doing that the way he was doing it. His dialects, I mean, Jonathan Winters had done it. I'm not saying he was everything was so original, but Robin was really a powerful actor, an improv guy. But then.
Well, yeah, he was trained at Juilliard.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. You could tell he was a trained actor.
Yeah.
And so there weren't that many comics, especially in the Bay Area, so we really stood out. But a lot of comics didn't want to open up for rock and roll bands. And that's where I got my – that's where I sort of became the Pitbull of comedy.
Holy shit. So what bands did you end up opening up for?
A lot. I mean, Dana Carvey and Kevin Pollak would open up for all the little Boy Scouts like Pablo Cruz and the Beach Boys.
Sure.
And Melissa Manchester. I mean, it's never easy opening for a band.
Because they're not there to see comedy.
They're not there to see comedy.
They're there to see music.
Yeah, and I don't care if it's Vegas, Diana Ross, or Four Tops, whatever. Not if it's easy, but it's a lot easier than opening for a punk band like the Stranglers or the Tubes or Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, I opened up for, and there were a lot of 80s pop bands in San Francisco, Eddie Money and Huey Lewis in the News and Greg Kinn.
Awesome.
I mean, they were the middle of the road pop guys, but still people were drunk and stoned in the audience. They're not there to see a comic.
No. You know, right. They just kind of want to be there and zone out and listen to something.
Yeah, and I was a fucking wise ass, so I really would push their
Did you
buttons.
Attack the audience a little bit?
Yeah, and you know, and when things were going good, I went out of my way to give them shit. Yeah. You know? I mean, the cocaine and the vodka didn't help. Oh, well, actually.
Maybe it did.
No, it did help. Yeah. I don't want to be so negative. It helped a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it helped a lot.
And, well, in like, in, you asked, like, how did me and Adam get funny? I don't know about Adam, but like.
Well, you're
I,
not Adam
but,
so much. How yeah. Did, yeah. How'd you get funny? Well, like. The jury's still out on this guy. No.
Well, like I came up doing like Mexican restaurant gigs where you just show up and the patrons there don't know it's a comedy show.
Oh.
They're trying to watch the damn Laker game and all of a sudden they shut it off and go, okay, we're going to start the comedy show.
Yeah,
and,
shut it off or keep it on and say, hey, you have the choice to watch the game still or listen to the Dorf tell jokes.
See, that's almost making me cringe because mm-hmm. even though I think we all have our stories, mm-hmm. like the Blues Brothers playing behind the chicken wire and the cowboy bar.
Sure.
But I actually haven't done that, but that story you just said, that I might have had one or two gigs like that, but that is
really where,
I mean, opening for bands
I've had
is tough.
Tons of those, but I mean, so many of those bad bar shows that was literally like where you're screaming over people because there's a section of people listening,
right.
But a giant section near the bar that is just like, hey, man, we came for what we're doing
playing,
right now.
Yeah, they're playing pool, they're doing blow.
Yeah, and their fun is like overpowering, you know, you. So you're really having to scream at the people who are listening, and they're, and then they're like, "Why are you screaming at us, man?" Like, well, we're listening.
I think when I started out in the late '70s, early '80s, comedy, since it was a comedy boom, people were more interested in it. So when a club had a comedy night, people mm-hmm. showed up. I think by the time you guys started, and it happened when I was starting out too. But I think a guy goes, "Hey, you know what? We're not using the stage tonight. These comics want $20. Yeah, we have a mic. We have electricity.
We have
a bar stool.
Yeah, totally.
And so what the hell?" When you know, and then they would throw you up there, and all you guys, when I say you guys, I mean comics are just desperate to get any kind of stage time,
sure.
a few bucks to pay for dinner, then you'll take any gig.
Yeah.
And so it does make you a better comic. You know what? And it does thin out the herd. It does weed out the guys.
It does.
Be doing this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because a lot of those rooms will be think that they, you know, we have a mic, we have a stool, and one light, and sometimes that is enough, but more often than not, like, those rooms, like, I've done a bunch of those, they're just not conducive enough, because the place is like, yeah, people will just come, right, because they don't know how a comedy show should be there. Like, we have one light, and then, like, I went there one night, and he's like, the light's not really working. That's still cool, though, right? I'm like, because we got the mic and the stool, though, and it's
no.
Well, dude, no, like, you gotta, this is already a bar, there's already TVs, and, like, everything's not set up for it.
It's so amazing how, and us as comics know this, how easy it is to put on a comedy show in terms of, like, it's so simple of what you need, yet how many people fuck it up.
Well, it's easy to put on a comedy show.
Because they look at us as clowns. It's like, you can just get up there and, like, you should be able to do it anywhere if you're funny. Like, that's, you know.
But it's easy to put on a show, but it's not easy. Well, it is easy to put on a really good show.
Sure.
You know, I was playing this shithole. I'll tell you the name of it because I'll never go back to Harvey's up in Portland. I mean, a horrible club.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they give away the whole room. Nobody's paying for the tickets. And they don't really care because they don't pay the comics much money and they just want to sell the food and drinks. So I went up there about 10 years ago and they were starting to use headliners. They were, instead of using all these local guys, they said, well, maybe we'll spend a little money and we'll use some bigger names. So I was the first guy they did this experiment with, and I'm on stage. And, you know, that crowd's pretty rowdy. There's a crappy little spotlight on me, but right next to the stage, there's a bigger spotlight on the sandwich board, on the specials. And I said, you know, it's hard enough to keep the attention of drunken idiots. It's hard enough to keep them focused on the stage without a bar out there and a TV in the back and this and that. And I said, you should at least shut the... There's more attention given to the specials and the sandwiches than to me, well, we got to sell food. And I tried to explain to the guy. I said, by the time I go on, the show's 45 minutes away from being over.
They should have eaten already.
They should have eaten by now.
Yeah.
And they should have ordered. And we don't really want them looking at anything else. But simple little things like that, nobody seems to care or understand. You know?
Yeah, because then essentially you're opening for a Reuben sandwich.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, and it's just hard.
It doesn't matter how good the Reuben sandwich is.
Yeah, and that's why it's been 35 years in show biz hell, because there's still been, and it still happens. I get these gigs and I go, I just can't believe I'm doing this. You know, they stopped doing this, but in the Factory Comedy Factory outlet in Baltimore.
I did that show.
It's a good club, but years ago when I went there.
They still do the three shows on Saturday.
Well, I stopped doing those.
Woo!
That three shows on Saturday is brutal. And you know what I complain? Because there are people now probably listening to you guys who just came home from a day in the minefield. Or,
somewhere, and they're like, well, I would kill to do three shows.
Of course. But really, and when you're headlining, it's really, really tough. But at the time, when I played that 10 years ago, it was all you can drink. And I said to the owner, who's a nice guy, I said, really, all you can drink? And he goes, you know, really, I'm in the alcohol business, not the comedy business.
Jesus. And, well, there you go.
You know?
That's exactly what you want to hear as the comedian.
Yeah.
And, great.
But all you can drink. And what happened, I might have done three shows because it was a late show Saturday night. There was a woman up front that threw up up front. And then a guy walked by and slipped in it. And I'm on stage, you know.
Were they a comedy duo? Were they like trying to fucking up you?
Set up punchline?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to do my show.
You don't
show.
Have a banana peel. Fucking, you throw up real quick, bitch.
I'm trying to do my show, and I look 20 minutes later, and the same people are still drinking. At least in the Old West, they pick these people up by the pants, and they throw them through the swinging doors. But they just go like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
they have somebody
brutal.
Clean it up and just get them another drink.
Brutal.
Now, you talked about how you like to help out comics. I'm about to do the Montreal Comedy Festival with you.
I stopped helping comics.
Oh, okay.
I was just being nice to you to get on the podcast. No. Yeah, that's going to be...
And that's been your show for how long?
Well, what's interesting is that, have you ever been up there?
I'm going up this first time this year.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, what are they putting you in? New faces, relationships?
No, I'm just from this movie that I just did other shit, they're just letting me go up and be on shows. My buddy Chris D'Elia is going up, so I'm going to be on a handful of his shows.
It's a great, have you been up there, Brad, right?
No.
No, that's right, we talked about first that when time. I saw you. Mm-hmm. You know what's great about that, and I haven't been to festivals all over the world, but the Montreal Comedy Festival, I think they were the first ones to do this. I know there's one in Edinburgh now, and
yeah.
There was one in Aspen for a while, HBO did one. Mm. But it's so great because Montreal's a great town. The women are beautiful.
I keep hearing that.
The women are mind-boggling. And, you know, I mean, I've been to a lot of places. I haven't been around the globe. But in North America, it's one of the... And it's plus it's the summertime, so they're not bundled up. Usually they look like Eskimos. You can't tell if there's a man or a woman or a Yeti under there.
Well, sometimes that's half the fun. Yeah.
Well, it gets really cold.
Yeah.
But the summertime is such a great town. But what's great about the Nasty Show, the show that you and I are doing, is that... what they did at the Montreal Comedy Festival, it lasted a week is how it started. Now it's expanded to
almost a month now.
Well, it's like a month, and they have all last year it was maybe too big. Hopefully they scaled it back because they had so many one-man shows and so many performances and in giant theaters. What's great about Montreal, they have more theaters in that town, and they have more underground passages to get to the mall and the theaters because in the wintertime, you really can't go outside. People want to be inside.
Yeah, it's freezing there.
So with like a 5-6-block radius, there's all these theaters, and last year, there, I think Amy Schumer, Patton Oswalt, Lewis Black, Robin
Jesus.
Williams, and everybody's selling out, but for years... What they did was, and they still do it, a week of shows, and they have a relationship show, and a new faces, guys that are trying to get sitcoms.
Ethnic show,
black people, and the gay show, and you know, and then the bubbling with laughter, and the bar mitzvah show is Jews, and so on. But the Nasty Show became, I think Dom Herrera did it first, and it was called the Danger Zone, about 25, 30 years ago.
Then Kenny Loggins sued you, and then it was all that thing.
It's a Danger Zone, and it was at midnight. And then the next year, I hosted it, and then they called it the Nasty Show. Mm-hmm. And the show was so popular, they kept adding another show. They kept adding another show. They kept adding another show. And finally, they didn't have room to keep adding shows because the venue that they had it in, Club Soda, had 500 seats, and they needed it for all these other shows. So for about 15 years, what we did was, maybe even 20 years, we did the Nasty Show, like 17 shows in a week. 2 shows every night, 3 shows a night on the weekends. But you only have to do 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But every show would sell out. And they had us there for a whole week, the week before the festivals. And we'd get great write-ups and newspapers and the magazines would write all about us. The following week when the industry came up and all the casting people came up and the network people came up, all our reviews were down, the new reviews.
Oh,
it's like our show never happened. So what they do now is we're going up. I think we're doing it the same time as part of the festival. And then a week later, we're doing a few more shows the next week.
Yeah, we're doing – I know I'm there for 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And they got great, great restaurants. Yeah. It's a great – there's my groceries. I brought them into your place here, so I don't have to leave them in my hot car. That's the thing. When you're married 25 years, all I have left is food. I drink wine from Trader Joe's. I can't afford blow. I would do blow in a second. People, are you 58? You got high blood pressure. What the fuck do I care? I don't care if I die from blow. I just don't want to walk around, I'm being on a show with Brad Williams and driving a clown car, you know.
Oh, wait, you are.
I am driving a clown car. By the way, do you see the color of that car? It's a bright blue cube.
Is it really? It's like teal. It's like when he drives by, like American Indians just go, hey, that's the color of our jewelry.
When my wife and I went to get it a few months ago, they had gray and they had black and they had white. And my wife picked me up at the airport all the time. And all these little cars start looking alike, the Hyundais, the Cubes. I said, let's get this blue. Because unless there's circus in town, nobody's driving that car.
Nobody's going to steal it, right?
I know that'll be for you.
That, and he's driving around West Hollywood. When he just stops at lights, the gay pride parade forms behind his car.
Yeah, yeah, they think you're just a part of the parade. Right. Now, in all honesty, like what? So 20 plus years marriage?
25 years.
So what is, I mean, you obviously, there's, you know, you're keeping it together. So what are the contributing factors to
alcohol.
That? In all seriousness. That's a piece of it.
Well, what's kept it together is the fact that my wife for many years had a clothing store in Santa Monica. And,
well, so you're getting free jeans out of this shit.
No, it was a woman's
that'd keep me in
store.
It, too.
Okay. Oh, well, it's a woman's clothing store. Well, you know, we all have different tastes, Bobby. We don't judge.
Which that car I should be wearing with this clothes.
Hey, man, if I'm low on cash, I'll wear some mom jeans just to get.
But what was great is that when I was home Monday through Wednesday, she would basically get up at 10 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, and go to work. So by the time I got up, she was gone. And then I'd make dinner, and I'd knock off a bottle of wine. And by the time she got home, 7, 8 o'clock, we'd eat dinner with a TV show. We'd watch The Sopranos or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or some Dexter, whatever. Mm-hmm. We'd watch a show, and then by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, I'd go down to my office, play my drums, jack off. I come back up, she's sleeping. I go to sleep. So I wouldn't see, and then I leave Wednesday or Thursday to go back on the road. So I wouldn't see her very much. So that's the key. I'd see the broad a couple hours a week.
Perfect.
Right. You know.
Right?
Yeah, well, I mean,
distance makes a heart grow fonder, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Distance keeps a marriage together. And it makes a heart grow fonder there. You want to be a poet
that's
about it.
That's just a nicer way of saying it.
Yeah, it's a nice poetic way of putting it.
But I think also if you get married, like these kids that you talked about who would come out of college and get married like 21, when you're coming out at 21, you don't have enough money to buy a big house or an apartment with separate rooms. You're in a one-bedroom, like one-other-room house, so you constantly see that other person. So that can't be good for the relationship.
Oh, and then you see these couples, and I never got this, and I guess people had to do this in the old days. You know, our grandparents, you know, had these mom-and-pop stores. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you did that.
Yeah,
you
know, with my grandparents.
They ran a little candy shop or laundry. I mean, a lot of people still do that. A lot of immigrants. But my God, you go home with this woman.
Oh,
you got to work all day with this fucking broad.
Yeah.
Oh my God. and then you see guys. This one I never got when they play golf with their wife. I mean,
what?
Golf.
Who's doing that?
No. Well, I used to.
My dad does that. It's insane.
That is.
Isn't golf supposed to be the time when a man like can get away and have his thoughts and?
Yes.
It's like talk shit about his wife with his buddies.
Yeah, exactly.
And if that doesn't work, you take up drastic sports like ice fishing. Where at 3 o'clock in the morning in Montreal, you're
that's fishing. All it is, isn't it?
No, honey, I love ice fishing. Yeah.
We don't.
I have to get away from this woman. And then you see these guys with their wives. You know, it's just amazing.
I would take up a really obscure sport that, like, you the practice times you could never question. It's like, I'm doing the luge. We got to practice at 4 to
I'm doing
4 a.m. to 6 p.m. Yeah.
There's a lot of couples that do shit that I don't, you know. I mean, not really. On a different note, you know, I remember taking my daughter to Disneyland when she was little, and you'd see couples getting married. That was Disney World in Florida, or it could be L.A., is one of the top honeymoon destinations. Not just honeymoon, but getting married. There's like Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, and then people get married at Disneyland. You know, if you're not old enough to make the commitment, that to me. I can see an Elvis impersonator marrying you. And I can see getting married, you're parachuting out of a plane, doing something crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But Disney World, Disney's for children, and you're not old enough to be married if this is what you're doing.
Of course. Also, that to me is comparable to like the jumbo screen, like at a sports game. Like just basically like you're basically pointing to it and going and then, you know, going, hey, look at that. Eh? Like that's the person you want to spend your life with? That's fucking romantic.
I remember once I was with my daughter at Disneyland and I made the mistake the first time I took her there. It was the summertime. And I realized when you're 4, 5, 6 years old, kids can miss school. I'd say to my wife, I'm taking her out of school. Really? She's going to, like, what is she going to miss? You know, it's
finger painting.
Grade.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not missing anything.
Right.
So October, you know, or Disneyland's always crowded, but I try to get a time when the Europe's not on vacation, Americans are on vacation, it's not Easter, it's not any kind of holiday. And it would still be a pain in the ass, but I take my kid to school, and she said, Daddy, missed the exit. I go, we're not going to school today, we're going to Disneyland. And I remember one summer, though, it was a hot day, and we go to Disneyland, and my kid's got to go in Country Bear Jamboree. And there's two guys standing behind us, and I think, obviously, they were gay. And this, but what was amazing to me is the line was so long, and I kept saying to my daughter, there's so many things we could do. Don't you have to pee or do something? Don't you want a snack or Mickey Mouse ears? And I just couldn't stand the line knowing I'm going to see these singing bears. After about 30 minutes on, I turn around to these two guys who did nothing wrong and go, what the fuck is the matter with you today? And I think they, because because they're gay, but it wasn't that.
No.
The fact that they're adults and they're waiting in line for the singing animatronic bears. Don't you have a hobby? Can't you go ice fishing? I know you
can't go ice fishing.
Nothing to do with being gay.
That just shows you how desperately guys do want to get away from their wives. It's like we're leaving a house that has a large TV, any channel, there's internet, there's porn, but the wife is there, so we say, fuck it, I'm going to a cabin in 20 below weather with a hole in the water.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we're doing.
You know, the first time I went to Disneyland, though, was with another guy when I just moved out to California, and I'd never been there before, and I was playing a club, not there anymore, the Laugh Stop in Newport Beach, and I go, you know, we're not far from Disneyland, I always wanted to go, and for some reason, I hadn't taken LSD in years, and somebody...
No, that's...
Somehow I got LSD, or mescaline, or peyote.
Somebody, well, fucking Goofy is an addict, so I'm sure he slipped
and
them
that
to
was,
you.
It was great.
Yeah, oh yeah, if you're not going to Disneyland, I mean, the last time I went to Disneyland was on a pot brownie. Before that, it was on pot cookies. I mean, as an adult, I don't know why you're going sober. Like, you've seen it as a kid.
Right.
And even if you haven't seen it as a kid... Like, what you're going to see as an adult isn't going to change your life unless you're...
Yeah,
unless...
Well, maybe the two guys you saw at the Country Bear Jamboree were on acid. Yeah, like, maybe. Singing bears on acid? Holy shit!
But then what reminded me of that is because I went to see the Singing Bears, and they were great. So maybe I totally misjudged. I totally misread.
Did you have any sort of moment while you were on LSD at Disneyland? Because for me, on a pop ride, the time... Like, I knew it was time to leave when I told Winnie the Pooh I was having a heart attack, and I think... To me, I was like, all right, this is probably a good sign to grab my bags and head for the exits.
The only thing I remember is seeing the seven dwarfs going, Brad! Hey! He didn't even turn around and talk to me.
Well, that motherfucker stays in character. He doesn't
talk exactly.
Well, I don't remember.
Happy doesn't know Bobby Slayton. What's up? No, it's funny because I actually did used to work at Disneyland.
Did you really? What did you do?
I was the bodyguard for the characters.
Oh, you really?
Bodyguard.
So I'd walk around with the characters and you know, I'd... Every 5-year-old step out of line, I have to give him a little forearm shiver. But for the most part, it was a fun job.
It sounds great.
Yeah. And you have no idea, like, when...
He was also the fluffer for the Singing Bears.
Well,
somebody has to.
Yes. They need a little picture.
Someone had to get them ready to go on stage. And damn it, I've got little hands. So, but it was always interesting because there's something about Disneyland where people just have this idea of magic.
It's an escape.
Yeah. So where I'm like doing stuff with Winnie the Pooh and I'm like taking pictures and then these parents like walk up to me and like one leans down and goes, I don't know how they got you in that costume, but that is unbelievable.
Really?
And it's like, it's called a genetic disorder, bitch.
Wow, really?
What the fuck? Wow. Like, really, you think Disney magic is like finding some tiny, tiny, tiny Chinese guy, sticking him in a tiny, tiny white guy costume and then like parading him out there? No. Yeah.
They don't do that? Well, thanks for reading that for me, Brad. Another Disney myth shot to hell. You know, there's two great books. You read those books, Mouse Tales, about behind the scenes?
No.
About the deaths there and why they got into some of the rides and some of the people got all the kind of things that went on.
There was I think a kid fell off like the Matterhorn, I think, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, but there's always, there's cooler stories than kids dying, but
I mean, don't get me wrong, that's their opener.
Yeah, I mean, when Chip and Dale gangbanged that 7-year-old, I mean, that was much more exciting.
They had real burrows or donkeys and they would actually bit a couple of kids on one of the gold mining things when they first opened. I think misfired and backfired. And
donkeys bit kids?
But they had some donkeys or they had something. In the original rides, you know, they've transformed them over the years, of course, to make them more.
Maybe that's why they went to animatronics. They had real, actual singing donkeys.
Yeah,
and
they had something.
They got disgruntled over the wages. And they're going to bite some kids if you don't fucking
before
pay
my time.
Yeah.
You know, before my strikes.
What's also, like, people when they go to Disneyland, they just have this expectation of the perk vacation. I'd be out with just the characters and then people literally form lines to nowhere.
Right.
Because, like, five people would be standing next to each other, and then six people would be standing in line, and seven people.
You're not making any decisions for yourself at that place.
No.
You're seeing a group, and you're like, oh, that must be what we should do.
Yeah. And then, the family stops eating their ice cream. They start walking out. Now it's obvious that the line is not a line. And then they get mad at me because, like, why the fuck didn't you tell me I was standing in. Not a deadline. What is this ride?
Did you see they just raised the prices at Disney World? I was just playing Orlando Improv. Yeah. And I just looked. There was some ad where a family of four could go and stay at one of the Disneyland hotels. It's like thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How people could...
It's robbery.
It really is horrendous.
It's awful. It's because you're not getting the experience. Like, whatever you're paying for. I mean, I guess it's you. People, I think whatever they're going to get out of it is
for $1,000 for the princess, it should blow me.
Yeah,
it's, you know what I mean, like I should have Snow White.
Sure.
And by the way, that would be an attraction. Me fucking Snow White. Holy shit!
A lot of people would pay to see that. I'd pay more than $1,000.
Have you ever been to Orlando? It's a horrible town. On top of that, because it's all there's like 5 theme parks.
Wait, that's for Disney World? Okay, I've been to Disney World.
Theme parks and it's swamps because you know Disney went in there. They bought all the land. Never told anybody what they were going to do. You know that story, right? And they got it.
No.
But well, Orlando, whenever they opened it, what was it, 30 years ago, whatever, it was all swampland. Orlando, there was nothing there. But if you broke down churches and horrible strip malls and pawn shops, and that, you know, Florida's like that basically. They have all these depressing strip malls where there's a pawn shop, a liquor store, and an adult bookstore. So it's like this: you can go in, you can pawn your stuff, you can jack off in the car, get some liquor, and then buy a gun and shoot yourself in the head. It's like a one-stop suicide center. That's the entire Florida strip mall of gun stores, pawn shops, liquor stores, and anyway, that's all it was. So Disney went in and said they didn't say who they were, and they bought all the property up. And then, of course, these landowners were pissed when they found out.
Yeah.
You know, so after Disney, then it's MGM. But anyway, I'm staying in a hotel. I'm playing the Orlando Improv. Nice club. But right next to where I am, it's helicopter rides. And I don't want to go in a helicopter. The guy comes to my show and goes, Bobby, how about a helicopter ride? This is also a fortune. It's like, you know, $100 a person for an hour. And you get in a helicopter and to see swamps, theme parks, more swamps, mini mall. What are they building over there? Another theme park, another swamp, another bridge. And this is what you're paying for to look at this shit. If you don't actually want to go to this shit, you look at it from up in the sky to see what you can see.
Which is somehow, more magical.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to me.
When,
you know, way off track.
Yeah,
with
exactly.
Disney,
right?
When did you decide to move from, you said you were born in New York.
Yeah.
And then did you make that move to Los Angeles to pursue comedy?
No, you know what I, yeah, no, no. You know what I did? It's interesting because there's a chapter in my book called Go West, Young Man. That's original.
Okay.
When I was a teenager, you know, I always wanted to go to California because in the late 60s, I'd always heard about San Francisco. You know, it was, the Grateful Dead, the Haight-Ashbury.
Sure.
And, you know, by 1969, when I was 14 years old, started smoking dope, and then Easy Rider came out around that time.
Dennis Hopper movie. Best movie.
And Peter Fonda. And they're driving across Captain America. You know, they're driving across America, and they're selling dope, and they finance their trip on motorcycles. I'm a Jew. I wanted to go by car.
Air conditioning gets a little better.
Yeah, there's two things that kill Jews.
It's not very safe on the motorcycle.
Motorcycles and Nazis. These are these Jews like to stay away from. So I always wanted to go to California. And then when, you know, my friends were little and they went to Hollywood and they, you know, they saw Mickey Rooney's house and then they went to Disneyland. I'm going, I gotta get out to California. So when I was 20, I drove cross country with a lunatic friend of mine. Never even thought about doing stand-up comedy. You got to remember back then, you know, like 1975, I'd seen plenty of stand-up comics on, you know, the Johnny Carson show and Ed Sullivan and Merv Griffin. I had seen Leno, but I'd seen the old guys, you know, Alan King and, you know, Shecky Green and even David Brenner.
Shecky Green,
and,
oh, I mean, my God.
There were a lot of great comics, but, you know, I think Billy Crystal and Robert Klein were starting to do it when I was a kid and George Carlin, but never thought about doing it. You know, never, because a lot of guys, you two probably also maybe thought, hey, I want to be a comic when I grew up. Anyway, I went out to L.A., and it was horrible. Yeah, you know, I love L.A. I love it. Oh, I hate that song, but I hate L.A.
Yeah, it's not. It's not what you think it's going to be as soon as you get here.
No, it was.
What did you think it was going
to
be?
You know, if you go to the beach and you go to Malibu, it's what you think it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And you go to Hollywood Boulevard. Back then, even it was kind of sleazy and disappointing. You could see there were remnants of what it was before they rebuilt the Capitol Theater and before they fixed the whole place up. You know, it was pretty depressing. But driving up the coast was magnificent. I mean, if you guys ever drive up between L.A. and San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
When I got to San Francisco, the hippie thing was ending. The gay thing was kind of starting. It was a gay-hippie kind of transition phase.
Same clothes.
I think gay hippies playing at the Troubadour next year.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was a great town. And then when I was 21, somebody said to me, you ever tried to do stand-up comedy? I said, no. And there was a club called the Holy City Zoo, and I went in. And I said, I should try this. I was a bike messenger downtown, 21 years old. And I put together 5 minutes. And being a bike messenger in San Francisco was not an easy job. Because
no,
there's a lot
hills.
Of hills.
Yeah, hills there. Holy crap.
And I was making minimum wage. And I just decided I'm going to try stand-up comedy. And I still have the tape. I still have the audio tape.
Wow.
It's a cassette. I have it somewhere, which I could probably never play anyway because I don't know anybody who has a cassette player.
I've actually got my first Sony if you want to borrow it.
Yeah, really? I don't think I want to hear this set again.
Do you even remember like the first, like some of those?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. But, I look what I was doing after 5 years. Now it's pretty bad too. I mean, it's worse than what you're doing now. That's how bad it was. Bad at it.
But like, bad. What? Do you remember like what world were you writing from? Like, what was?
I was talking about stuff like I remember I had a joke about Frankenstein, about how they brought a Frankenstein. And, you know, in the castle, he blew up the castle at the end. And the monster goes, "We belong dead." And he pulls the switch to blow up the castle. I go, who builds homes like this anymore? On, off, blow up castle. Is there a switch next to the... I was actually kind of funny.
Yeah,
I like that.
But I was... If you're a good comic, you can make the premise funny. But I wasn't a good comic. As you know, if I took Jerry Seinfeld's act, who's one of the greatest comics I've ever seen. But if you took his act and you put on paper and you read it, you probably say half the stuff, it's not that funny. Mm-hmm. You know, even Jay Leno, who's a joke machine, it's attitude, it's delivery, it's the whole
presence.
I'm telling you,
everything.
I don't have to tell you.
Do you think that's consistent with everybody?
Well, no, because again, you look at a guy like Rodney Dangerfield. His jokes are just great.
Right.
His deliverance and cadence and look made him funnier.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily know Seinfeld's material is like that, but a lot of my stuff is pure attitude. It's not really, if you look at it on paper. That's why, and I'm sure this happened to both of you guys, there's nothing worse. Well, there's a lot of things worse, but when you get a review and they liked you, oh, this guy Adam Ray is brilliant, he's a great comic, and they quote one of your jokes, and someone's reading, go, this guy sucks. Because if they only think...
Yeah, because they're reading the joke.
Right, or they change a word.
Right.
There's a couple of writers that I know who've given me great reviews over the years, and they'll quote one of my jokes, and it's a great joke, but if they change one word...
Oh, God.
It's just... And Seinfeld was a master at that. It just screws up the whole joke. It doesn't.
How do people get away with doing that, by the way?
Like, they're not comics. They don't do it. I mean, I'm saying they like your act. They think you're really funny. Mm-hmm. But when they
quote, or even if they take an excerpt from something to try to use to, like, you know, say he's great, like this little piece right here. Oh, cool, you took like one phrase or sentence from a whole five-minute bit. I mean,
I used to have this, one of my famous bits, you know, was this Chinese waiter routine, and which,
this,
you know,
is great.
So I'm not going to sit and do the whole routine.
Sure, sure.
But somebody told me over the years, you ever hear Buddy Hackett's famous, he had a famous Chinese waiter routine. John Panetta's a famous Chinese waiter routine.
Mm-hmm.
But the bit was basically about how Chinese waiters just agree with everything you say. You know, is it spicy pork? Oh, you came my friend, yeah, spicy, yeah. Yeah. And they just, that's all they ever do. You know, they just, your head's on fire. Yeah, head on fire. Okay, my friend. They go, oh, are there crayons in this? Yeah, you have crayon, everything. So I remember a writer quoting this. Are there crayons in it? Yes, yes, there are crayons in it. What that doesn't mean. Without the Chinese voice.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And even if you say, now insert Chinese voice here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, for the Montreal Comedy Festival, they're having me write out my entire set for the HBO thing.
Oh, you're doing HBO thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're and you write out every word, and I'm reading my act back going, I'm not very fucking funny.
No, you know what? I did that last year for them.
Yeah.
And I don't do a lot of those shows because I don't like working in that 5-minute constraint where, you know, what's your opening joke? The last time I did it was on Jimmy Fallon's show last year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wrote down the material. And, you know, who was the guy? I forgot who was the guy that was the segment producer. But he was smart enough that he worked with enough comics where he got it.
Right.
And I said, let me just call you up. We'll go over it together.
Sure.
And he said, I don't need to. I get it. But I'm reading it. I'm going, this just doesn't look funny because, you know, unless you do the voice. And
the inflection, the body movements, everything. So all that comes together.
That's why I don't understand how people, and I'm not saying they can't do it, but... Mm-hmm. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I guess we've all learned to become better comics, and I've learned to become a better comic on my own. You know, it's like playing guitar or karate. People can teach you, and then you got to practice.
Yep.
But I wonder how much people can teach you. And there's guys that give classes, and people have told me they've taken classes, and they've gotten better from the classes. But I wonder how much you can actually learn from that if you don't have it, you know, inside you to do stand-up.
I think one of the things that the classes do is they force – you to get up on stage and do it. That's half the thing doing it.
That is half the thing.
Yeah.
And you do want to hear the criticism.
Sure.
Because, you know, the one thing I can never do, and be like, you ever stand in front of a mirror and do it? No. It's like acting. No. Stand in front of a mirror. To me, that would be the last thing.
I'd rather stand up in the mirror and jerk off than do my act in the damn mirror.
But I don't see where that would help you because you're just looking at you. That's not what you're going to see when you're on stage.
There's no reaction to that.
Right. I'll tell you what I did learn more than I tell young comics. The only thing that the biggest thing that ever helped me was after I've been doing stand-up for a couple of years, I did my first TV show. And when I saw myself on TV, I saw how bad I was. Hunched over and talking too fast and watching yourself.
You talking too fast?
Faster than I...
I can't believe that.
No, that's how people say that once in a while, yes. But I used to really talk. fast. And
holy crap.
I
mean, like the damn micro machines.
Early on, because
guy.
Wait, because you were just trying to get to the joke. I mean, I talked really fast when I first started, and I think a lot of it was nervousness and being like, I just want to get to the funny part, but then, and you know, and also being uncomfortable with silence and not understanding the power of pausing. And
yeah, I'm very uncomfortable with silence. I'm very uncomfortable right now. Now,
would 5 seconds of silence just destroy you right now?
Freaking out. No, you know what it is? Is that when I started out, I had to talk over all these bands, and I was the MC and only had 5 minutes.
Oh, shit, there it is.
And there was being an MC, the cocaine didn't help, the nerves, it was a whole package deal, you know? And now I just naturally talk so fast that it's just me.
When was there a moment that you could look back and say this was the break or the thing that made you go from this is just kind of a hobby to holy shit, I'm actually doing this. I'm a comedian.
You know what? I think that the time you say I'm really a comedian is when you don't have a day job. You know, when you're making a living at it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I shouldn't say that because there's a lot of professional actors that have to wait tables to put food on their own table and pay bills, and they're still professionals. But I think that I really felt that I was a comedian when I did not have to have a day job. I used to work at nightclubs. There was a nightclub called The Boarding House in San Francisco the first time I saw Robin. And, you know, it was really a thrill for me. It was I just started doing stand-up comedy. And David Johansen from the New York Dolls, who I loved with a passion, they were playing the David Johansen group. And Sandra Bernhardt was opening up for them. And I really wanted to open up for the David Johansen group. I just started doing stand-up. And I watched them the first night, and Sandra kind of died. She didn't do well. Mm-hmm. And the next night I come to work, and they said they just fired Sandra Bernhardt, or maybe she quit. I don't know. But they want you to go up and open up for the David Johansen group.
Shit.
When I was a young comic, oh, wow. So I ran home. I lived about 5 blocks away to get my props. I had props.
Whoa, what?
I had props. Not Carrot.
Bobby Slayton, the prop comic.
Not Carrot Top's had props.
I can't go on without my water gun.
Guess what I had.
Is that your Carrot Top impression?
No, that was Don Mariera from Seinfeld.
Oh, God.
I can't go on without my water gun.
Yeah.
Here's what I had. I had a cap pistol, and I don't remember what that joke was for.
Okay.
But I had a giant fly taped to the inside of my jacket.
Oh my God.
And I did a scene with the fly. Help me, you know, for the fly.
Right.
I don't remember. There had to be something funnier there. I don't know.
No, that sounds like it was it.
It does sound like it. And you might be right. But here was. I had a copy of a Leave It to Beaver TV guide, a real TV guide from the 1960s. And I opened up the TV guide, and I don't remember what I said. So I had a joke about Leave It to Beaver. It was when Test Tube Babies first came out, and I had a test tube in my pocket. It was one of my big jokes. This is why I needed my props.
Okay.
I said, you know, I couldn't find a babysitter tonight. I had to bring my kid, and I took it to test tube.
Okay.
And I said, and as long as I brought the kid, I had to bring the twins. I had two test tubes taped together. Watch out, Carrot Top. Look out, Rip Taylor.
We got this. Bobby Slayton's on the way.
Oh, yeah. But my big ending, and I don't know why I did this because nobody could see it, but it killed all the time. I talked about how, you know, stamps, this is right when they started putting people on stamps. You know, it was always presidents.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the Lincoln Memorial. President,
who was the first one they
Davy
put on?
Crockett,
wasn't like
the first person they put on a stamp that wasn't a president.
It was like an entertainment figure.
Oh, God, I remember.
Might have been Elvis.
Elvis?
No, sounds no, way right. Before that. And they had all poets on, and they had all kinds of doctors on.
Martin Luther King.
Okay, yeah, they had Martin Luther King. But now they have, you know, all kinds of people.
Now they have Darius Rucker from Hootie and the Blowfish. And it's not really
you have to be dead.
Yeah.
Why they don't do some serial killers, I don't know. I'd love to see Son of Sam still alive. Night Stalker, Manson, you can't have, he's still alive. But they should make an exception.
They should. Be.
Or Berger, Hitler, Mussolini. But anyway, I talked about stamps. It would put anybody on a stamp. And I pulled out a stamp. I still have it. And it said, America celebrates discovery of the pap test. And it was a 15-cent stamp. That's how much stamps letters cost to mail those days. The pap test, you know. And there was the doctor, whoever discovered the vaccine,
right,
with a microscope. And I said, a pap test stamp? I couldn't bring myself to lick this and put it on an envelope. That was good night, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
If you thought I could top the test tubes, I did it right there.
And would you open the jacket with the fly one more time as you're walking off stage?
It was so embarrassing.
Here's how much times have changed. I typed first celebrity on stamp into Google right now to try to get it. There's nothing but pictures of tramp stamps. Just like nothing but tattoos and like something.
My daughter's got one of those. I brought her to get one when she was 15. I got this one.
Yeah,
and she got her little tramp stamp. She's now in a band. My daughter's gonna be big.
I saw on the internet she's in the Is she in the Pussycat Dolls?
Well, she was the Pussycat Doll. They just changed the name because okay. I think the Pussycat Doll a franchise is getting a little old. Mm-hmm. So the woman who did the Pussycat Dolls, Robin Anton, they're now called Girl, GRL, but they're managed by Britney Spears' manager.
Oh, shit.
So,
that's good.
You know, and this guy, Dr. Luke and Max Martin, I guess are writing all the songs for all the pop stars. So they're writing for the girls. So if you buy Britney Spears' new record, you get her song free.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow. Well, now you being in the entertainment industry, when your daughter comes to you and says, I want to be a singer, what's your reaction?
I'll tell you a funny story. This is also in my book. This is a great story.
Yeah, where can people get your book, by the way?
Not out yet.
Perfect. <Yeah. laughs> Perfect advertising, Bobby. Perfect.
I just like to tease people.
Yeah, you got to. So, that's great.
When my daughter was 9, mm-hmm. I was on the Tom Arnold show on the WB Network.
Okay.
And it was Tom Arnold, I think Michael Rosenberg, who played Lex Luthor in Superman. It was Ed McMahon, who's been Johnny Carson's sidekick. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty good cast. You know, Gene Simmons' wife, what's her name?
Shannon Tweed.
Shannon Tweed. Yeah. And it was a really good cast. So we taped at Universal Studios. And every Friday when we taped the show, my daughter would come down and she'd hang out backstage. And she became friends with the two little girls who were on the show. Mm-hmm. And my daughter said to me, Daddy, I really want to be an actress. And my wife didn't want to get her into it.
No,
you know?
Sure.
And I said, you know what? Let's get her an agent. She's not going to get anything. She's a very talented little girl, but she'll get out of her system. If she gets something, fine. She has money for college and a car. She doesn't get anything, back to school.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we got a really great agent. I brought my daughter to see these agents. And they said, Bobby, look, we're not going to bullshit you. We think your kid's really good. You know how many parents come to us? But we think your kid's going to make it. So 3 weeks later, she gets an animated series.
Wow.
3 weeks?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
I've been trying for 8 years.
I know. My God.
15-episode MGM series called Lionhearts, where Perry Gilpin is her mother and William Macy is her father. It's about a family of lions. Okay. So she gets 15 of those. Right. Okay. It's 15 of those. A couple of weeks later, she auditions for a new ABC sitcom called Brother's Keeper. And they bring her in. I know you guys have read for stuff before. Right?
Yeah.
You know what it's like. It's horrible.
Yeah.
You know, you go in, then they put you on tape, then you go back for the casting director, then you go for the producer, the assistant producer, the director, then they come back, then the network, and they can bring you back 4 or 5 times. My daughter went in 7 times. 7 times, because she never acted before, and it was a major ABC series. Okay. So she gets the part, and here's the great part. Not only did she get the part on the ABC series, guaranteed 9 episodes out of 12, 13, whatever they do now, the Tom Arnold show goes off the air a few weeks later. Her show goes out to the same set at Universal Studios as the Tom Arnold show. But since I was only a recurring character on the Tom Arnold show, my dressing room was one of those little bathrooms with a door out in the parking lot with the cleaning supplies. Right. My daughter right next to the set has a giant dressing room with a bedroom, a television, a shower, and a goddamn parking space. She's nine.
She just parks her Razor scooter right there.
Yeah, Natasha Slayton parks his man. So, God. And it was great. And
Great, right? Yeah, you're not...
No, I was thrilled to death.
Weird about
and
it,
they loved her on the set. And the directors, the producers, Bobby, how long has your daughter been acting? I go, a couple of weeks. She'd never done anything before. She was really, really terrific. But what was great for me is that every Friday when they taped the show, if I could, I would go to the taping if I wasn't on the road. And after the dress rehearsal and dinner, she'd have an hour off. So we'd take a walk through Universal Studios because all the tram rides had stopped and the tours had stopped. We'd take a ride. We go over to the Norman Bates house to be sitting on the psycho steps above the Bates Motel eating ice cream and going over her lines. And then if security kicked us out, we'd walk down to Transylvania to the Frankenstein, you know, this little fountain.
Yeah.
I'd say to my kid, you know, someday you're going to appreciate this. She goes, no, I love it now. I had to think about a video camera. I said, that's what they did, Creek from the Black Lagoon, Mikhail's Navy.
So awesome.
It was great.
Wow.
It was great.
And now look at her now, right?
That was pretty cool. Now she's like her mother.
Call back. Oh my God! If you guys listening have never seen Bobby Slayton live, there's a reason why they call him the Pit Bull of comedy, because you are just relentless.
Yeah, you're unreal, man.
It never stops. And if you didn't like whatever joke you just said, wait 15 seconds. There's another joke coming.
Well,
it's crazy.
That's why you're gonna love Montreal, because the nasty show is a show. And by the way, every comic thinks you got to be really dirty. It's not about being dirty, being blue. It's just about saying whatever you want to say, from the N word to the F word to anything, as long as it's funny. And it's more to me, not the dirty show. Why are you doing the dirty show this year? To me, it's freedom to, you know, because as you know, the podcast, what's great about it, you do radio now. Everybody's so uptight, from Paula Deen to the president leaving his mic on to all, that's a homophobic slur, and he said the F word, use the N word. Up there, you do whatever you want. And if, and then, you know, your excuse is, hey, you don't like that word? It's the nasty show. Go see the relationship show. Go see that idiot Adam Ray and the dude playing basketball show. Talking about his new movie because he has no act show in. You know? I don't know what you're doing.
That's it.
See,
no, that's the show.
See, that's right, the pit bull.
That's the show.
I even attacked my friend. Nobody's saying we're up, Bobby. No.
Perfect. Can our listeners find you on Twitter? Are you on Twitter website?
Pitbull of comedy. Nobody cares. Every time I say something, I get four more followers. I lose four more. You know, I try so, but I'm trying to build it up now because I have my book coming out soon, and I
want. You got to, yeah.
But again, you love Montreal. What's really tough though is I've done it so many times. Every year I got to come up with new stuff, and it's really I have to set a bar for myself. You can do whatever you want. They'll love you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just great. I mean, and the fact that we're playing a theater and it's 500 people to show and they're just there to laugh and have a great time.
It's the best show in the festival, yeah.
You know what? There's a lot of great shows. Now they've set the bar really high, but it's the most consistent show at the festival.
It's awesome.
Because, you know, but you know what's funny? I've been doing it for over 20 years, and not usually, but sometimes there's just one guy or one gal that just doesn't cut it. You know, it won't be you.
It's not gonna be
Brad. I don't know if you know, but this motherfucker has a dance. Also, you just running out on stage is gonna make people go.
Hey, you know,
I didn't say that to me. You know?
No, I know, man.
What's one? There's just a comic that I said, where did you see this guy? But everybody does good. I mean, Lisa Lampanelli got a standing ovation. Unfortunately, your friend Carlos Mencia got a standing ovation. But then again, he was doing everybody else's stuff. But
yeah, you know.
I had to say that.
It's okay.
No, Carlos, great performer.
Yeah.
Good. God bless him.
Bobby Slayton, he's going to be live on stage with me at the Montreal Comedy Festival July 16th through, the 28th. We're going to be there.
Yeah.
It's nuts. So,
we have to go to Moishe's Steakhouse for one of the best steaks I've ever had in my life.
I will go there with you. I will sit and enjoy my steak and not say a word the entire dinner.
No, actually, when I was sitting there, I you know, when I'm not working or performing or on a podcast, I don't talk much.
Okay.
I'm very quiet.
Okay. We'll see.
Well,
Adam, plug your stuff.
You got all these tour dates on here, Bob. You want to plug any of these?
What?
On your website. You got like your fucking calendar. This is from top to bottom.
It's Phil. Just go to BobbySlayton.com. I'm working more than I ever have, making a third of the money.
It's awesome.
It's perfect. It's a great time.
Yeah.
Adam Ray, plug your stuff.
Adam Ray Comedy for Twitter. Go see The Heat. AdamRayTV.com. We'll be at the Parlor Live next weekend, the Punchline San Fran, and Montreal with these guys. Maybe going to steak dinners.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Brad, go see The Heat.
Yeah, the movie The Heat, which made $40 million in its opening weekend. Congratulations, thanks, Adam Ray. BradWilliamsComedy.com. Go follow me on Twitter, @FunnyBrad. Later in July, like we said, I'll be at the Montreal Comedy Festival. August 2nd to the 3rd at Hyenas in Fort Worth, Texas. August 8th to the 11th at the Improv in Kansas City, Missouri.
Bobby!
Bobby Slayton. Adam Ray, I'm Brad Williams. Please try to remember our names in the morning.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, Slicinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.